Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program where we get to meet the people who make a difference in our lives and in our community. This is Bob Willard, and we will be visiting today with Gunter Schuller, composer, conductor, educator, performer in classical and jazz forums, music publisher, record producer, and all-around Renaissance man of music. For the next hour or so, we'll ask Gunter a few questions, play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. Gunter, welcome to Profiles.
My pleasure. Pleased to be here.
Gunter, let me introduce you to our listeners by mentioning some of your accomplishments. Starting as the principal horn with the Cincinnati Symphony at age 17 until today, August the year 2000, where he was the guest conductor of the Indiana University Summer Festival Orchestra, Mr. Schuller has covered every area of music from jazz to classical. His compositions have won the Pulitzer Prize. His recordings have won Grammys. He has been recognized as Composer of the Year by Musical America, a classically oriented magazine. He has been honored by Downbeat magazine for his contributions to jazz. Gunter has been president of the New England Conservatory of Music and artistic director for the Berkshire Music Festival at Tanglewood. He has written dozens of essays and books on jazz, swing, and the art of conducting. He is without a doubt as complete a musician as we have seen in this century. And he is with us today. Gunter, you came here to Bloomington to work with the students in the festival orchestra.
Yeah.
You do so many things, and yet you find time to work with the artists of the next generation. How and why do you do that?
Well, first of all, I've always been interested in education, speaking of that in the broadest sense. And, of course, when you conduct a concert in a school, you are, in fact, teaching. You are, or you should be, the young people. In this orchestra, by the way, as I think everyone here knows, there are, of course, faculty also involved playing many of the principal positions. So it's a very fine orchestra. But I've always spent my time conducting some of the most famous orchestras in the world, you know, Berlin Philharmonic, New York Philharmonic, whatever, but also lesser-known orchestras. And I have found through all the 40 years that I've been doing this that sometimes the musical experiences you can have with less famous or less experienced orchestras who are still eager to learn, to you know, and who are still excited about music. Sometimes, you know, some of the major orchestras, they get a little cynical or, you know, bored with their work. Some of them do. That you can have some of the most extraordinary musical experiences, you know. And so for me, this has been a rich kind of almost cafeteria-like experience. You know, you conduct all kinds of different orchestras. And insofar as I'm also a person who loves to share my experiences, which, as you just mentioned, are so varied, with young people, well, that's just part of it, you know. And I've always, even my years, of course, at Tanglewood, that's what I was doing there, conducting and teaching young people. I mean, that's the essence of those summer festivals. Let's take a Brahms symphony. Brahms is one of the greatest composers of all time. In fact, most people don't even know or suspect how innovative and how forward-looking he was in certain respects in his music creation. Now, the Brahms Fourth Symphonies, all the four symphonies, have been played for 20, 30 years. And in so many respects, as I really discovered when I wrote this book, The Complete Conductor, I mean, I was in a state of shock most of the time writing this book. In so many respects, these wonderful, fantastic masterpieces are played to some varying extent or another incorrectly. By that I mean conductors might, for example, insert ritardandos or accelerandos where there aren't any. Or and not just minor subtle ones, but really excessive ones, you know, to make some kind of a musical point which doesn't have to be made. Or if Brahms writes pianissimo, you know, the whole orchestra is playing mezzo forte, which is not the same. Pianissimo and mezzo forte is quite a different in quality and mood and in sonority. But anyway, so In listening to, I think it was 68 recordings of the Brahms symphonies, the first and the fourth, I discovered that most of the time, even by, especially by incredibly famous legendary conductors, what was on the page there written by Brahms was to some extent ignored or rejected. And I don't even comprehend this. My life in music, my conducting particularly, and my teaching consists of considering these scores, as we call, you know, what we play from, sacred documents. I mean, it's like a religious thing to me. And I must respect those sacred documents fully and live by them and do my best and do our best with our talents, whatever they are, to bring out the real truth, the real essence of those pieces as they were so meticulously notated and defined by Brahms. Now, that doesn't mean that out comes some kind of incredible mechanical, stiff, unexciting performance or rendition. Quite on the contrary, because it turns out that Brahms knew much better than certain famous conductors what the music should sound like, what he intended. And this is a phenomenon in the history of conducting, and not just the recent history, that I really don't comprehend. I don't know why people who out of one corner of their mouth say, you know, Brahms is one of the three greatest composers we've ever had, and then the other side of their mouth, they go ahead and do an interpretation which does severe damage or injustice to Brahms's work. Now, the audiences wouldn't know this. You have to study a score in great detail to know what are the deviations in recordings and performances on these pieces. And this is true of Beethoven symphonies, Tchaikovsky, it doesn't matter what. As soon as a piece becomes world famous and becomes, you know, one of the 50 pieces that are played all the time, then those composers, who are, of course, all dead, are in trouble.
So you feel a strong integrity to interpret accurately what the composer wrote.
Absolutely. I devote my life to serving these composers. And by the way, contemporary composers as well. You know, I mean, any composer. But yes, that's my credo. That's my life. That's my love. And it's so exciting when you get to the bottom, so to speak, when you get to the real inner essence of a piece of music by studying every fly speck that's on that page of score, on those pages of score. You meet the composer, as it were, almost as if he or she were alive. And then out of that, with the orchestra's cooperation, you evolve a performance which can reflect exactly what the composer wrote in all of its details, and B, especially because of that, an exciting, living, breathing performance. I believe, by the way, very much in a wonderful saying by the great German-American architect Mies van der Rohe, who one day, you know, somewhere in the 20s, said, "God is in the details," which, by the way, some wag later corrupted into "the devil is in the details," confusing everybody. But anyway, God is in the details. What did he mean by that? He means that geniuses, whether it's Michelangelo or whether it's Picasso or whether it's Tolstoy or whether it's, you know, Beethoven or Brahms or whoever, put things into their creations which are beyond the sort of general ordinary things that maybe many people can do, but they put in certain significant details of expression, of design, or whatever it might be, that is peculiar and probably limited to that level of genius. And we have to respect that, I believe.
When you find a score, and when you take the score, what do you do to study it? How do you go about breaking it down?
The answer to that is very simple. And this is seemingly what some people don't do, or they think they already know the score and don't even bother to look at it in any detail. What I do is I look I just mentioned it. I look at every note, every note. There's nothing that's insignificant in a score. There's nothing that's gratuitous. Everything is important and significant. I look at every fly speck in the score. I mean, I often said to some of my students, I said, my eyes are like a vacuum cleaner, and you just pick up that entire page, and you commit it, not to memory necessarily, but to commit it to your mind. And you do that page by page through the work. Now, this may sound arduous. Actually, it's, you know, it's the greatest thrill of my life to study these scores, even after I've conducted them many, many, many times. Because there's these pieces are so rich in their invention, in their imagination, that in truth you sometimes find things that, you know, 10 years earlier you hadn't even realized or seen. And it has to do with doing justice to the not only to the notes that are written, but how they are played. How do they all blend together? How do they balance? How do they all the thousands of notes relate to each other in a score or in a performance? And when you have studied all of that intimately and then translate that into the appropriate conducting gestures that will yield that result with an orchestra, well, I think then you've probably done your job, you know.
You mentioned Van der Rohe a minute ago.
Yeah.
And a lot of your, well, some of your pieces seem to have been inspired by visual arts, the American Triptych,
yeah,
which you did here,
yeah,
in Bloomington,
yeah,
and then the Paul Klee variations, yeah, or themes.
Quite a few others, too, yes.
What is the inspiration that you get from works of art?
Well, first of all, I should say that when I was a kid, I turned out to be very talented in painting, drawing, designing. And I thought for a long time that I was going to be a painter. Or an artist. And well, actually, then music got a hold of me, and so on. But I have always had, for I don't know for what reason, I mean, we can't explain these things, a very deep fascination with the visual or the sculptural. And so when I became a relatively, you know, known composer, I used to live, by the way, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I mean, I was just there 3 or 4 times a week. And I saw all this great artwork, of course, also growing up in New York, you know, the Metropolitan Museum of Art and all of this. I was always going to museums and buying art books and all that. So one day, in fact, my very first orchestral piece, which is now on a recording on my own label, and it's called Vertige d'Eros, The Madness of Eros. And it's based on a painting by the Chilean great painter, expressionist or surrealist painter, Mata Echoren. And that painting was the first thing you saw after you paid your $2 in the Museum of Modern Art to get in. When you started to go up to the galleries, that painting, which is huge, stood hung there on the wall, and you know, I stood there transfixed on that staircase looking at this painting many, many times. And one day I was 19 years old. I said, my gosh, I'm going to try and translate that into musical terms. And that was the first of those experiments. And so it's just my love of the visual and of color and design and shape and all those things. And there is a really remarkable parallel or connection between the visual and the musical, the oral. There are certain things you asked me, you know, how does that inspire you? Well, sometimes, you know, we can take certain shapes. We can make shapes in music. Designs, gestures, right? I mean, something goes up, something goes down, or it goes slowly, or it moves fast, whatever. Well, painters do the same thing very often. Now, of course, there are certain things which you cannot describe in music, but you can take shapes and designs and gestures and translate them into oral form. There's no, and that's really what I've done, particularly in the Klee pieces, where I picked 7 of the 9,000 Klee designs and paintings he did in his lifetime. that were already based on musical subjects. You see, because Clay, by the way, was the opposite of me. He was a wonderful violinist, musician in his young life, and he thought he was going to be a musician.
Well, then how important do you feel for a conductor, a composer, anyone making music, to be familiar with other disciplines in the artistic world?
Well, I think it's incredibly important. And I must tell you, if you look at the history of music in the 17th, 18th century, if you look at some of the tutors or musical study books and so on, it was simply understood that you weren't just a composer, you were also a writer, you were also a painter. I mean, you were involved with all of the arts. You were a philosopher. You were all these things. You read Matteson's, I don't know, 500-page thick book about how to become a musician. It's absolutely required that it was in those days. Now, of course, long ago, it isn't that way anymore. But I think it certainly enriches your knowledge, because all the arts are in some way related to each other. And they're all, you know, whether it's choreography or whether it's painting or literature, because we all deal with ideas, forms, concepts, you know. We just use different métiers, different means of expressing that. So any other knowledge, whether it's of literature or of painting or ballet or films, great cinema, it's all bound to enrich your comprehension of the music that you're doing.
You mentioned the Matteson book is what people read, but you started off your career relatively young professionally. You were playing with the Cincinnati Symphony when, what, you were 17?
Well, I was playing with Toscanini when I was 16. So.
Well, it would seem to me then that you got a lot of your training on the job as versus going through academic institutions.
Yeah, I'm a high school dropout.
but yet you've been president of one of the most prestigious music schools in the country. How do you combine the two, and which is the best avenue for someone to take?
Well, look, I mean, what I did, first of all, I came from a musical family. In fact, my two sons, who are rather terrific jazz musicians, they are now the sixth generation of musicians on my father's side. So, I mean, I was filled with music, probably even in my mother's womb, you know, let alone in my entire childhood and all of that. So perhaps I was destined to become a musician, but I can't explain much of that happened because you know, I cannot understand why, for example, at age 11, I could sight read any kind of music, whether it was atonal or tonal or simple or complex. I can't explain that. I can't explain why I have a very strong sense for harmony, for harmonic development in music, particularly chromaticism. I mean, is this genetic? Is this chemical? What is it? We don't know. So it just happened. I guess I have to say that I was talented musically. And starting with music when I was 11, which is kind of late. I mean, let's not forget, you know, Mozart started at 4, you know. I developed very quickly, and I took some horn lessons with a famous teacher in New York. And 2 years later, I was playing as a professional, as I say, with Toscanini and other orchestras in New York. So I was self-taught, except for the horn, and I just studied like mad. I mean, I spent every day. I finally quit high school because I wasn't learning anything anymore. I had gone to some fabulous private schools before that. I was sort of 3 years ahead of where everybody was in that Jamaica high school. So I spent all my waking hours going to libraries, getting scores and studying music and all of that, so that by the time I was 17, 18, I really, it sounds like I'm bragging, but I really knew an immense amount of music already and, of course, was composing, because that's the first thing I did, and was developing as a composer. And the fact that I became president of the New England Conservatory, I didn't even know what the difference was between a graduate and an undergraduate degree. I mean, how should I know such a thing? You know, I was playing in orchestras when I was 16 years old. And that was just the most amazing thing to me that I was invited to do that. But you're right. I mean, what you said is sort of I learned everything either on the job or on my own. And it was very exciting, you know, discovering the whole world of music.
Well, your father was a violinist in New York.
In the New York Philharmonic, yeah.
And so you attended concerts there. And
oh, sure.
This nurtured a lot of your interest.
Yeah. And a lot of this happened unbeknownst to me. I mean, I was taken to concerts, you know, when I was 5 years old, 10 years old, 8 years old. And I wasn't particularly interested in music at that time. But it turns out that I was nonetheless absorbing all this musical information in some mysterious way. And at one point, who knows why or how this happened, I decided, wow, I want to compose music. I have no idea where that came from. But I could then begin to do that because I already knew, without even realizing it, that I knew a vast amount of classical literature already at that point that I had, you know, that was in my genes, that was in my brain, in my heart.
Did you learn it all with the right rhythmic integrity?
Well, I certainly tried to.
You mentioned both your sons are in the jazz world, that's an area in which you've had a lot of experience.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's, again, I didn't even push them in any even musical direction. You know, in fact, my older son, he was so involved with space travel and spacecraft design and everything that I thought, I guess he's going to be a space scientist or, you know. But suddenly at age 14, which is even later than I started in music, he turned to music. And 2 years later, he was working professionally. So we can't explain these things. You know, a lot of it is genetic. A lot of it is environmental. Meaning, for example, that my two boys grew up in a house where classical music and jazz were played all the time, either on the radio or, you know, with the rehearsals with my colleagues and friends, you know, in my home and so on, especially jazz.
Oh, did you bring Miles Davis home to play with him?
Well, I did. I mean, Eric Dolphy, Ornette Coleman, they were all in my house. I mean, my two kids, you know, when they were 3 or 4 or 5 years old, they met all these people. So their lives were filled with music just as mine were. Although in my young life, my father had no use for jazz. He thought it was a kind of irrelevant or perhaps even degenerate music, you know, some mere entertainment music, not realizing what great masterpieces had already been written by Duke Ellington and Count Basie and Benny Goodman and so on. So, but my two boys heard everything on both sides. So one day they just turned to jazz, and the rest is history.
Well, I want to go back a ways to the concert you just did in Bloomington. You work with Corey Sarovsek, the violinist.
Yeah.
When you deal with a soloist in a concert, how do you come up with the interpretation that you as a conductor and he as a soloist or she as a soloist can gel on and work together on?
Well, of course, that depends on the two persons. I mean, it takes two to tango. And I have had many wonderful experiences working with soloists, and I've had some terrible experiences where I felt they were so deviating so far from the written document, the written score, the text, that I simply, in such cases, since the soloist is, you know, the dominant person in a two-person team, I guess, you know, certainly from the audience's point of view, you know, the audiences look for the soloist. They pay their money for the soloist. So sometimes I simply give up. I mean, if that's the way somebody wants to play this piece, I just accompany as best as I can. But the greatest pleasure is when I have a soloist, and Corey is like that. He's very well trained. I mean, look, he had a fantastic teacher, and he is himself an innately gifted musician who respects the notation of the music that he plays. So he simply is somewhat like me in the sense that he's truthful to what he plays. Now, again, this doesn't mean that, therefore, you will hear some kind of mechanically correct, rendition of a piece of music, because we human beings, when we deal with the emotional expression of a piece of music, there are variabilities there. There are vacillations in tempo and expression that are, in fact, what make music a great musical and emotional experience. But it has to somewhat reflect, in my humble opinion, what the composers wrote. And Corey is one of those artists who loves to do that. I won't mention some of the names where we had, disasters of performances, but where I simply said, okay, well, this is what he or she wants to do, and I'm just, and, you know, I said, okay, orchestra, look, we just follow the soloist, you know. I don't enjoy that.
No, I can imagine that gets a little frustrating because it doesn't
meet
your integrity.
Yeah,
your sense
and, you know,
of, right.
if it's a younger person, not yet with worldwide acclaim, you know, and, you know, a 20-year recording contract and all that, you know, you can sometimes get to somebody. I felt that I could. But at other times, the soloist is 30,000 times more famous than I am. And, you know, what am I going to do? Argue with, you know, someone who's also making 30,000 times more money? I mean, you know. So it points you win some and you lose some.
Do you feel that for a young performer, listening to recordings can be more detrimental than helpful?
Absolutely. In fact, that is one of the main problems in any orchestras that I conduct. And let's assume that the musicians are all technically more than competent. I mean, nowadays, orchestra musicians anywhere can play anything you put in front of them, at least from a technical point of view, of getting the notes, you know. That's not making music. You know, everything about music making is beyond getting the notes. As Mahler said, it's what's behind the notes, it's what's in the notes that we have to get and express. And so what happens, I mean, just over and over and over again, some famous violinist or cellist or trumpet player or whatever makes a recording. And let's face it, of the Beethoven or Brahms symphonies, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of recordings, most of them by world-famous legendary conductors who are either no longer living or are still roaming the earth, you know. And in school, one listens, you know, in a conservatory, so you tend to listen to recordings. Now, if that recording, it might be very exciting, it might be brilliantly played in a technical sense. If, however, that has certain serious deviations from the score, well, unless that person studying that piece is also now looking at the score and saying, now, wait a minute, they're not doing exactly what this composer wrote, you know. If they just listen casually, they'll pick it up that way, that, you know, deviated way. And that'll become the way they understand the piece. And if a conductor now comes along and says, wait a minute, that isn't really what the composer wrote, well, you're in trouble sometimes. They say, what do you mean? I've played it this way for 10 years. You know, this is the way it goes. Well, folks, no, it doesn't go that way necessarily. A dear mentor and friend, a great pianist named Eduard Steuermann, when I was still very young, he said, you know, Gunther, one of the most dangerous things is to listen to a recording because you can be influenced, particularly when it's, you know, a great pianist like Schnabel or Rubinstein or whoever. You know, out of sheer respect for these great people, one tends to accept what they do as the, you know, biblical truth. And he said, I know you're studying a lot of recording. I was a big record collector. I have, 10,000 recordings, 78s, LPs, all that. He said, I know you're a record collector, but be careful, you know. Look at this music also as you listen to the recording, and you'll see some interesting things.
Well, that's a beautiful segue into listening to a recording. So let's take a break now and listen to some music.
Okay. Yeah.
let's listen to the 7 Studies and Themes of Paul Klee by Gunter Schuller. We'll listen to The Little Blue Devil, played by the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Antal Doradi. We have just heard Little Blue Devil from 7 Studies on Themes of Paul Klee by Gunter Schuller, played by Antal Doradi and the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra. This is a composition from 1959. Our guest today is Gunter Schuller. As Alan Rich said, he isn't merely a musician, he's a monopoly. I like that. You were talking about mentors just before we had a break. Could you elaborate on who have been your mentors and inspirations?
Oh, there were so many. Ah, my Lord, it started, well, apart from my father, of course, who was not my teacher, but he was a tremendous influence on me because I heard him practice and play and all of that. Apart from that, when I went to the Cincinnati Symphony, there were some wonderful older musicians who had been born in the 1880s, and particularly the concertmaster and the first cellist of the orchestra had, in fact, studied with Brahms, or they knew Brahms. And I was instantly aware that these were precious people from whom I could learn a lot. And so people like that, they were the Hermann brothers, Emil and Walter. And there was another musician in the orchestra, a violist, who had played with Furtwängler in the Berlin Philharmonic, but had emigrated to the United States. Those were sort of my first three mentors, and particularly the latter one. He was one of these polymaths. He not only introduced me to all kinds of musical ideas and things, but literature. He got me reading Tolstoy and Shakespeare and Proust. You know, I was only 17 years old. So then later, then came Mr. Steuermann and Rudolf Kolisch, who was Steuermann's partner and close friend. And Kolisch is the great violinist for whom Schoenberg wrote all of his violin music, including the violin concerto, but all the chamber music and so on. And these were two of the greatest musicians of that era. I mean, there were many others. These happened to be, you know, from sort of the German wing of things. And I happened to meet them when I was 19 years old, and they became very influential in directing my life. And I played often with Steuermann, Brahms' horn trio. With Kolisch, I played the Schubert Octet and the Beethoven Septet when he was teaching at Madison, at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Then another, perhaps the most important mentor or influence in my life was probably Dimitri Mitropoulos, because I could go on probably for an hour about him, but he put me on the map as a composer when he did something extraordinary he was at that time music director of the New York Philharmonic, and he did something that had never happened in Philharmonic's 100-year history. He performed 2 different pieces of mine, of a young composer, in the same season. That had never been done before. I mean, an unknown composer. I mean, obviously, Beethoven symphonies were played, you know, multiple times. Because in those days, the New York Philharmonic broadcast every Sunday afternoon, and the whole nation heard the New York Philharmonic. And after those performances, I remember, to my utter amazement, I was getting letters from older, famous composers, Aaron Copland, you know, Sam Barber, Walter Piston, I don't know, Bill Schumann, complimentary letters. They had heard my music on the radio, and they were, you know, wow, welcome to the club, you know, this sort of. And so these are some of the people that really had a major impact in my career, and either as a composer or as a performer.
Well, who was it that inspired you to take up the baton?
Nobody in particular. I never was interested in conducting as a young person. I was very happy being a composer and a horn player. But when you compose, it often happens to you that you can't. There's nobody who wants to conduct your new, difficult, unknown music. You know, that's nowadays particularly. There are hardly any conductors of the, you know, the famous orchestras who do any kind of significant amount of contemporary music. They just don't. Partly it's because, you know, they say, well, audiences don't want to hear this modern crap, you know, so we're not going to do it because we'll lose at the box office and all that. But anyway, as a composer, then you find yourself, you have written a piece and you really want to hear it. And, okay, you get together some musicians, and then if it's more than three or four musicians, you start having to conduct. You know, if I write a piece for 15 musicians, an ensemble, chamber ensemble, 15 musicians, that cannot be done without a conductor, particularly in a modern style. Then you start conducting. And out of that, and I had watched, you see, I have played with every major conductor in my years at the Metropolitan Opera and in the New York Philharmonic and freelancing in New York that you can name. Except, you know, I mean, one would have to exclude Furtwängler because he never conducted in the United States, you know. But I don't care whether it's Toscanini or Zell or Monteux or Bruno Walter or Metropolis or any of those major figures of that time. I worked with all of them. So I wasn't just sitting there sort of twiddling my thumbs or just playing. I was watching. I was studying the music we were playing always, and I was watching these conductors. Oh, I forgot to mention the greatest conductor in certain respects, namely Fritz Reiner. So I was watching these folks, and there were some terrible conductors, technically, who had no baton technique at all. And then there were geniuses like Reiner and Toscanini and certain others. And I watched all this, and when I started conducting, having observed what is the best way to conduct and what is not the best way to conduct, you know. I put all of that to use, and then when musicians in New York, some of the best musicians there, said to me, hey, Gunther, you know, you really do this very well. Your beat is very clear. You know, everything you tell us is logical. You should pursue this. And out of that came some notion that, well, okay, maybe I'll do conducting. And then the next thing I know, I was approached by a management who then put me to work conducting. The first major orchestra I conducted was the Chicago Symphony.
Which blew my fire.
That blew my mind, you know, doing the Schubert Unfinished Symphony with this great orchestra, you know, and other things. And from there, it just spread like wildfire. And in a way, I've conducted almost every major orchestra in standard repertory now. You know, okay, of course I always do a contemporary piece by myself or somebody, you know, but I'm not typecast necessarily as the guy who can only do modern music, and I'm very proud of that. And I had to fight that off a little because at first I did do a lot of contemporary music, and at Tanglewood I was in charge of the whole contemporary music festival. In Carnegie Hall, I initiated a series called 20th Century Innovations, which was wholly dedicated to contemporary music. And I found out at that time that people were already putting me in a box, you know, oh, yeah, well, he's pretty good in this modern stuff, but, you know, can he conduct a Beethoven symphony? Well, then I had to do something about that. So that's how I got into conducting.
Do you feel that a composer can bring things as to his conducting that maybe those that are trained as instrumentalists may not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, if I could live in a utopian world, a utopian society, And if I had something to say about how things were done in that society, I would ordain that anybody who wants to conduct has to also have composed. I don't say they have to be a great composer or even a good composer, but they must have experienced the creative process, the compositional process. What is it? How do you choose that next note, that next musical idea? How do you do that? How do you work your way through a piece? Now, when a conductor understands that, he is inevitably going to be a better conductor with more insights into the creative process that created the piece that they're conducting, you see. But without that kind of really deep involvement with the creative process, it's very rare. I mean, there have been wonderful conductors. Pierre Monteur was a violist. He was not a composer, but he was one of these geniuses who without composing, he had composer's insights. It's just amazing. So maybe my requirement is a little bit too strong, but it would be an ideal world. Because look, it's not enough to know what's in a score. And most conductors, I'm sorry to say, don't even know fully what is in a score. They know aspects of it, or they have a sort of superficial, across-the-top kind of knowledge of the score. You know, where to cue, hear the violins play, now comes the oboe, and now you give the horn a cue, something like that. But to really know everything, many conductors don't even do that. So that, to me, is a minimum requirement. But even better is when you know why any note in that score is there. It's not enough to know what it is, but why is it there? And that you will find out if you have composed and created pieces of music. And because then you can translate that knowledge into your interpretations. Ah, I see why this G natural sitting here is a dotted half note, and it's a French horn, and it's marked piano. I can see why that is, you see. Whereas if you don't know that, or don't even care, well, you might, not conduct a piano.
So I'm a young student.
Yeah.
And I come to you and I say, I want to be the complete musician.
Yeah.
What is your advice?
To do all the things that I did. Look, I happened to be born, thank God, with an absolutely insatiable, voracious appetite for music, And all music, ethnic musics, popular musics, jazz, classical, old, ancient, new, modern, it doesn't matter. And am I lucky to have this kind of a, enthusiasm for music. Now, because of that, even as a teenager, I spent my entire hours studying and loving and learning and listening to recordings and learning music. For example, when I was studying the horn with my teacher at the Manhattan School of Music in Upper Manhattan, I was living in Queens, with my parents. I had to take two subway trains to get up there to the Manhattan School of Music. I had a change at 53rd Street and Lexington Avenue. Well, I found out that at 58th Street and Lexington Avenue was the lending library, the lending music library of the New York Public Library. The New York Public Library, 42nd Street, was only a reference library. You couldn't take anything out. You could go there to study. But here at 58th Street, I could go, and I did it twice a week. I would go there and come out of that library with an arm choked full of scores, and not just orchestral music, operas, Lieder, songs. And I'd devour that music. And very often I had recordings already of those pieces. Devour that music in 3 or 4 days, or sometimes I kept it, for months, and I paid fines, library fines, because I kept the scores too long. And then I'd come back, 2 or 3 or 4 days later and take another huge armful. I did that for 2 years. I mean, you can imagine the amount of music that I, to some extent or other, absorbed. Well, that's what I would suggest to everybody, and particularly nowadays, because if you go back to my early years, even of a famous piece like the Beethoven Fifth Symphony, there were only three recordings. Now there have been 165 recordings of the Beethoven Symphony since the first one that was made in 1913 by Arthur Nikisch with the Berlin Philharmonic. Nowadays, the libraries here at Indiana universities are full of recordings, particularly in the CD world that we live in now. I mean, everything that's ever been written has now been recorded. In my time, for example, only two of the Dvořák symphonies had been recorded. So it was a very limited amount compared to now. But whatever there was, I certainly absorbed and studied and learned. Nowadays, I find, and this really bothers me, that young people with these immensely rich libraries, both of books and of recordings, you know, and of music, that we have in all the universities, all the conservatories, all the colleges of music, do not take advantage of these extraordinary resources. I don't know whether it is they think, well, there's so much out there, it's overwhelming, or, you know, I'll get around to it someday. Well, someday getting around to it may be too late. So that's because my educational philosophy behind all of that is that I don't care how great the school is or how diligent a student you are, in a 4 or 6 year curriculum, there is no university, no curriculum in the world that can give you all the knowledge that you will need in a full, complete musician professional career, which means that most of what you will eventually need, you sort of have to do on your own. I mean, you can have the best teacher, and that teacher will work with you on, you know, the 10 concertos you're going to play, or 20 or whatever it is, and teach you all the niceties and refinements and nuances of music making. But beyond all that, there's so much more that you have to eventually acquire in some way. Now, it takes years and years, of course. I'm the eternal student. I'm still studying. You know, I'm still learning music that I haven't known before. So that's my advice, to not be satisfied just with going to school. They tell you what to do. They assign you certain things, and you study that. And leave it at that, and then you get a degree, a piece of paper, and, you know, as if that were enough. It isn't. And, you know, I know that for lots of people don't like Wagner's music, for example. And what happens in every music history survey course, the teacher will say, okay, kids, your assignment for next week, you have to listen to Wagner's Götterdämmerung. Oh, groans, okay. But now they do it, but only because it's assigned. You know, I'm not saying everybody is like that. But you understand what I'm getting at? That a school can guide somebody. Here are the things that you ought to know about. These are some of the things I can give you, but there's a lot more out there, and that you have to do on your own. So that's, again, a long answer to your question about what should someone do. And boy, does that provide you with a richness of resources and energies and knowledge that you just can feed on then for the rest of your professional life.
One of the unfortunate things about doing a program that has a limited amount of time is we have to come to an end. Yeah, yeah. But I just have one question to ask.
Yeah.
What are you doing next?
Well, what I'm doing next, having written over 180 works and having done everything in music you can possibly think of. Well, you mentioned, you rattled off all of those six careers or whatever it is. What I'm now doing, because I've had such an unbelievably rich, rewarding, exciting life, I'm writing my autobiography, because particularly in the sense that I work consistently on both sides of the musical fence. I mean, you cannot name anybody who in the 1940s was working with Toscanini consistently and with Miles Davis, or with Pierre Monteur and Charlie Parker, or whatever it is, or with Duke Ellington and Leonard Bernstein. And I feel that I want to document this incredible life, privileged life that I've had doing all these things before I get Alzheimer's or, you know, lose it all. And, of course, I'm putting it in a historical context because, you know, we have Wynton Marsalis, and lots of people like him who are now involved in both classical and jazz. But in 1945, particularly on a French horn, I mean, that was unheard of, you know. And my parents thought I was crazy. Everybody thought I was crazy. What are you doing with this jazz stuff, you know? This is just a silly dance music, you know. So that's something I'm working on now feverishly because my publisher, Oxford University Press, just reminded me that I'm 9 months behind my deadline that they had given me. So I'm working, and as a matter of fact, here in Indiana, I wrote something like 40 pages of that autobiography. So that's what I'm working on. I have still 5 commissions that are sitting out there that I will fulfill in the next time. I will continue conducting, but I'm really devoting a major part of my time, free time especially, to the writing of the book.
As we finish the program today, let's listen to the Arioso from the Chamber Symphony, written in 1989 by our guest Gunter Schuller, played by this Cleveland Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Gunter Schuller. Gunter, we appreciate your spending the time with us today.
Well, thank you very much.
This is Bob Willard. Thank you for listening.
The program you just heard was produced in the studios of WFIU in August of 2000. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash. For WFIU, thanks for listening.